Today at Reader's Corner, Rob Percival, author of The Meat Paradox, Eating, Empathy, and the Future of Meat. I'm Bob Custra. Welcome to Reader's Corner. Should we eat animals was, until recently, a question reserved for moral philosophers and an ethically minded minority, but it's now posed on restaurant menus, supermarket shelves, social media, and morning television. In The Meat Paradox, Eating, Empathy, and the Future of Meat, Rob Percival, an expert in the politics of meat, searches for the evolutionary origins of questions surrounding our carnivorous appetite, asking when our relationship with meat first became emotionally and ethically complicated. Rob Percival is head of policy at the Soil Association, Britain's leading food and farming charitable organization. He has been shortlisted for the Guardian's International Development Journalism Prize, as well as the Thomson Reuters Food Sustainability Media Award. The Meat Paradox is his first book. Rob Percival, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Thank you for having me.
So, Rob, what is the Soil Association, and how does your work there lead you to a book entitled The Meat Paradox?
So we're an organization that promotes sustainable food and farming. And by that, we mean organic and regenerative food and farming. So we're looking to shift the food system away from its industrial basis onto a more nature-friendly footing. And I lead the organization's advocacy and campaigns around dietary change, because we know that this shift in how that we farm and produce food needs to be coupled with a change in the way that we eat. And in that context, I've become highly embroiled in this really divisive debate that's arisen in the last few years. You'll have seen it played out across the media, across social media. Should we eat animals? This is a really really evocative question. And we've seen the battle lines drawn in recent years and the trenches dug. So I wanted to understand why this question was so complicated, and especially why it was so emotionally complicated. And that led me to a body of psychological research and this fascinating tale, which I recount in the book.
So, by the way, you mentioned organic and you mentioned regenerative. What's the difference between those two?
So, I mean, historically, organic and regenerative are based very much around the same principles. They're both looking to put more in than they take out. So the opposite of regenerative would be extractive. Mm-hmm. You know, you're just taking from the land. Right. Whereas organic and regenerative, they're putting more back in, especially back into the soil. Mm-hmm. than historically has been taken. But I guess that one difference in Europe is that organic is defined in law and we have certification systems, whereas regenerative is a sort of broader term. I know in the US there are certification systems for regenerative, but they're typically oriented towards the same set of principles. It's sustainable food production.
When it comes to putting something back in the land, regenerative, let's use that term, help us understand why that's so important. And I guess what I really mean by that is, in what ways does that justify? Maybe that's too strong of a word because we're going to talk about moral philosophy here in a minute. But in what ways does that justify the need to have animals on the land? And once they're on the land, then, of course, the next question is, do we eat them? But I wonder if you could address what animals do to the land that makes that regenerative.
Yeah, so I mean the sort of intensive cropping systems that have emerged in the past 50-60 years have been heavily reliant on these chemical and fossil fuel based inputs, so synthetic nitrogen and chemical pesticides, and the focus has been on generating the highest yield possible, so lots and lots of food. And a lot of that has been channeled into highly processed food. A lot of it's gone into sort of factory farming animal systems, and the soil has been exhausted. Biodiversity has collapsed and then the sort of farmed landscape, because there's no room for bugs and insects and birds and so on. And the opposite, this regenerative approach is really predicated around building diversity. So building biodiversity back into the soil, healthy living soils, greater space for wildlife on the farm, less of these chemicals, which we know are bad for bees and pollinators. And in this context, we're talking about a greater mixture of crops and animals being present on the land at once. And it's that diversity of production which brings the regeneration. So a more diverse crop rotation and animals, such as grazing animals, cows and so on, who can, if managed correctly, help to bring the soil back to life through their manures. They can contribute to nutrient cycling, helping to ease our reliance on these synthetic inputs. So they can play a tremendously beneficial role. That's not to say that all cattle are good or that grazing can't cause damage, but in the right system, carefully managed, cattle can be part of the solution.
I was telling you before we started talking on the air that right here in the West, the American West, there's a movement afoot. Boise State Public Radio has reported, and Women's Work is an 8-episode podcast hosted by Ashley Ahern. And they're going around the West finding these women who are reimagining the way we raise meat and talking about the problems with the industrial meat system in the country. I thought it was quite a coincidence at the same time you and I are talking. We've got living proof that some of that's going on right here in our backyard in Idaho.
Excellent.
So let's talk about your contentions. You write that eating meat is entirely natural. We've eaten meat for millions of years, humans that is. But, and this is a big but, that doesn't mean it's morally right to do so. Help us with that one.
So the meat debate has been drawn along these lines where we assume that if we need to eat animals, if there is a role for animals in a sustainable farming system, then all we have to do is just provide higher welfare and a sort of humane death, as it's called, and that's the end of the story. But actually, what psychological science is beginning to understand is that there's a pervasive, often latent, but sometimes potent sense of moral anxiety associated with killing animals. Even when it's necessary, we can perceive the act to be acutely disturbing or perhaps even wrong. And in the book, I spend a lot of time with indigenous hunting cultures, some of them living in environments where it's undoubtedly the case that they need to eat animals. If you go to the far north, to the Inuit and so on, but they're still grappling at the center of their society with this question about what it means to kill animals. And there's a pervasive fear which shapes their cultural narratives, their social rituals, that meat might involve acts akin to murder. Now, that's not to say that I'm imposing a judgment that meat is murder on from the outside, but when they describe their experience of killing, sometimes the murder word is appropriate. They say, this is what it feels like. And this is the reason why we find meat so shrouded in taboo and ritual and narrative in every culture. We're constantly grappling with the risk that what we're doing might be wrong, or we might perceive it to be wrong. Mm-hmm. And I think what's happened in our society is that we've lost sight of that fact. We're not very good at talking about the fact that killing might be disturbing or distressing. We avert our gaze. And the psychological research that I cite in the book is showing that actually there's all these evasive and deceptive strategies that we use to look away, to deny our complicity in morally disturbing acts. So the book tries to strike a balance. It's not judgmental. It's not saying we need to decide immediately one way or the other. It's just saying, look, this is far more complicated than we've historically admitted. So let's become aware, let's become sentient of these psychological strategies, these cultural narratives, and find our place within the debate in a slightly different way.
Well, it seems like one of your main points is, in fact, I think you say in the book that you're a meat eater. But having said that, we cannot continue as a people anywhere on this planet to consume the amount of meat we've been consuming. Is that right?
I think that's true. Yeah. I mean, a large proportion of the meat that we consume comes from in intensive or industrialized farming systems. In the UK, that's mainly poultry and pork, an increasing amount of dairy. In the US, most cattle are finished on CAFOs, on these intensive feeding operations, even if they start pasture-based. Yeah. A huge amount of the poultry that's consumed in the US is industrial. And if we model what a sustainable farming system looks like, an organic or regenerative farming system, and then align our diets accordingly, we are talking about eating much less meat. Mm. And even in that situation where animals are playing a valuable role on the land, as the book argues, I think we need to ask difficult ethical questions about how we relate to those animals, how we treat them, how we talk about their death, and how we think about the farming that we'll be conducting in the future.
I'm Bob Custer, host of Reader's Corner. Today I'm speaking with Rob Percival, author of The Meat Paradox, Eating, Empathy, and the Future of Meat. The book offers a vital and nuanced investigation into the current debate around meat. So you visited a slaughterhouse in the preparation of your book here. Why don't you give us your impression of that visit, and then you might want to share with us what the research shows about the mind of a chicken.
So, yeah, I visited a slaughterhouse, and much of it was as you'd imagine. It was kind of a bit shocking and a bit gory. I was new to this, and I was trying to process it. You know, there was nothing untoward happening. The men were being very professional. But there was a moment that I shared with one cow where it was particularly intimate, where I was training with the vets, the veterinary surgeons who were there to who were there for the day. And I had a moment of intimate exchange with this cow as she was killed. We were looking at each other, and in that moment I became gripped by the perception that this cow was some sort of person, obviously not a human person, but a morally valuable person. And her death really stayed with me and prompted me to think about this book. It's the sort of experience that we spend most of our time avoiding, actually, engaging with an animal as a person in the moment of their death. Mm-hmm. In fact, it's what a large part of our sort of cultural apparatus is designed to defend us from. But it really struck me. And so the book unpicks, what was that about? Why did I perceive the cow that way? Was it an honest perception? What are we to make of this? And what does it mean for the way that we eat today? And then chickens. Yes. So chickens are really interesting, I think, in the context of the meat debate, because they're the world's most populous farm animal. They're the most popular meat. We eat a huge amount of chicken and farm billions and billions of birds. And we don't seem to be that disturbed by their mistreatment, at least not in the same way as a sort of large herbivore like a cow. We're more sensitive to the welfare issues associated with cows. And I explore some research in the book showing that this is to do with the movement of their bodies and the way that our brains respond essentially to the sort of pecking and clucking and jilting of their very different anatomy. Our empathy is stirred on a less fundamental level by birds and fish, due to these sort of ancient evolutionary structures which emerged in the past 2 or 3 million years, which shape our perception. So there's a sort of inbuilt bias, I suggest, against birds and against fish, which have very obvious ramifications for the way that we eat and farm today.
Yeah. Well, I felt that way until a friend of mine decided to bring a chicken into her home and in the backyard and her home. And I mean, it was just like a dog. The chicken had a personality. The chicken knew when to come in and get out of the rain. The chicken, you know, was just incredibly intelligent, if I can use that word, for what I thought was a dumb bird, you know.
Yeah.
And surprising. And anyway, let's move along with this idea of animal farming and the corporate ownership of farming. You do spend a little bit of time in the beginning of your book helping us understand, I mean, what's so frustrating about your book, as I think about it, is I think you've really nailed it. But then I look at the real world out there. I'm going to drive home and I'm going to drive by Chick-fil-A and Carl's Jr. And when I look at the lines of people for Chick-fil-A, I assume, by the way, that that's meat that's coming through the industrial farming system. Would I be right about that?
Yeah, I'd assume so.
Yeah. And it's like, wow, the odds are stacked against us. And then you talk about corporate ownership and how that operates. Please share with our listeners just who's in charge here.
Yes, there are parts of the meat industry that are highly consolidated. I guess most people in America will probably be unaware that the four largest companies, and that's JBS, Tyson, WH Group, and Cargill, process 85% of all beef, 71% of all pork, and over 50% of all chicken.
Wow.
So massive concentration of ownership. But these businesses offer over 60 meat-focused brands between them, thereby creating the illusion of choice and diversity, a facade that sort of hides them from view. And sometimes these have sort of rustic-sounding brand names, you know, Farm Fresh, whatever it may be. And similarly, when you look at what these animals are eating, the organizations, the companies that are channeling soya and so on around the world are similarly highly concentrated. So there's a few big actors behind the scenes who are responsible for the lives and deaths of billions of animals, really. And actually, when you drill down to the environmental impacts, which are commonly attributed to animal farming, it's really these big corporate actors that are responsible. It's not the individual or rancher or the family farmer. It's the big corporate actors who we need to be focusing on in terms of food system transformation.
So you and Farmer Patrick engaged in a conversation about veganism. This, I guess, is where we're going to let our meat eaters learn something about veganism. And what Patrick does, he points out the health concerns vegans may experience. I wonder if you could share those with us and why that adds to this discussion of the meat paradox. Maybe this is a good place for you to sum up for us. What is the meat paradox?
Yeah, certainly. So, I mean, we, as you alluded to earlier, we evolved eating both plants and animals, and we've eaten animals for 2 or 3 million years. And actually some nutrients are more easily taken up, absorbed in animal foods. And diets that remove all animal foods, such as vegan diets, are prone to certain deficiencies, not just B12, which is the common one that most people know about, but various other nutrients as well. I should add that omnivorous diets that include meat are also susceptible to certain nutrient deficiencies. So whether you're eating animals or not, you need to have a balanced diet. But there are challenges associated with a vegan diet in that health space. They can be overcome, but for some population groups, the risks are higher than others. So if you're a pregnant mother or a young child or an older person, you have dietary needs in which instance you might benefit from eating animals. So it's really complicated, and some of the health claims made for vegan eating are sometimes overblown. So the book says, listen, we have been eating animals for millions of years. They formed a really important part of our diet, but something happened somewhere along the way where we began to empathize with those animals. We began to feel compassion for the animals that we killed. We became an evolutionary oddity, a predator inclined to sympathize with its prey. And that's where this really interesting web of narrative and ritual begins to emerge in the human story. I trace this back at least 40,000 years back to the sort of Paleolithic cave art in Europe. But we've certainly been caught in this paradox. This for many societies in human history have been completely dependent on animal foods in at various points of the year and various environments. But at the same time, they felt this deep moral anxiety, this ethical distress over killing, which they've responded to in various artistic and creative ways. And today, I think, as the climate crisis escalates and we face all these environmental challenges, we really need to get a grip on this relationship, because industrial animal farming is putting us on a collision course with disaster. And we're tangled in all these forms of denial. We need to accept that our diets need to change. Vegans are part of the solution. Those eating less and better meat are part of the solution. We need to find the middle ground and rapidly phase out these industrial forms of production, because we're really running out of time.
You cite another farmer, John Lewis Stemple, who boils down his relationship to animals into three principles. You say it's eat less meat, do it sustainably and organically, and eat meat only at the ends of animals' lives. Boy, that seems highly impractical in the real world we live in.
Yeah, I mean he's a sheep farmer, and there's in the sort of in a European context that's slightly more viable for sheep than for other animals. But I think it poses a really interesting question. You know, what if we actually prioritized animals as morally valuable, as deserving of what we call a good life? What would that actually mean? What if we began to value them for their ecological contribution and their individual dignity more than just their meat? Even in higher welfare systems, animals are typically killed at a young age. These are systems predicated on producing meat. Whereas in the background of organic and regenerative farming, we have these principles which say, no, we should really value animal life and their ecological contribution. So there's some big questions the book poses around, which are, as you alluded to, some of them quite impractical in a sense, but worth asking, questions that are worth asking about how long we should let animals live, what sort of lives we should give them, and what a truly ethical and sustainable farming system looks like. Because I don't think it's really being delivered, certainly at any scale today. Even in higher welfare systems, there are big questions to be asked. So the book hopefully will prompt a few further discussions on that front.
You're listening to Rob Percival. He's the author of The Meat Paradox, Eating, Empathy, and the Future of Meat. Let's address this from the standpoint of climate change, Rob. I wonder if you could, I think you call it the planetary emergency that's staring us in the face. Why don't you take us through especially the case in Britain, I think, where some committee came up with a four degree increase in the temp across the globe, and where that takes us.
Yes, I mean, we know that the climate crisis is escalating. The science is now really good. There's still sort of debates around the side as to how the next few decades are going to shape up. But it's really the science is very convincing. We need to change course. And our diets and our food system are at the center of that. Agriculture consumes a huge amount of land. It contributes to deforestation and wildlife loss. And there are emissions released throughout the food system, many of them associated with animal farming, particularly industrial animal farming, both in the use of sort of fossil fuel-based fertilizers and in the form of methane, these cow burps, which everyone gets very animated about. I'm firmly of the view that we do need to change the way that we farm and the way that we eat. That does involve eating less meat, and that cows aren't the main culprit in all this. Fossil fuels are the main culprit, but we still have a really urgent task on our hands of reducing global methane emissions. And that needs to happen through changes in industry and industrial fossil fuel use, but also in the way that we farm, putting cows in a sustainable niche within our food system and our diets. And I paint this picture within the book of a future where we haven't fixed this, where we've reached this 4 degrees by the end of the century, which is what our emissions trajectory is putting us on course for at the moment. And it's fairly apocalyptic. You know, we're talking about large parts of the planet around the equatorial belt becoming biologically uninhabitable. It'll be too hot for humans to live there. Mass migrations, the collapse of our food system as drought and floods and heat waves and so on hit the world's breadbaskets. It's really dire. There's no reason to think that's inevitably where we're going. And I think we're seeing governments and citizens around the world awaken to the dangers. But we do need to make quite radical changes within the next decade if we're to avoid the worst.
I think if I was going to go looking for solutions to what you just laid out as the problem, the last place I'd look would be native populations somewhere in South America or somewhere in Siberia. You devote considerable time in your book to peoples who you suggest, and I would certainly agree with you, might seem like vestiges of the past, the Tucano, for example, but they might just tell us something about how it will be living in the world soon to come. You spend two or three chapters on this. I thought that was a very interesting part of your argument here.
Mm. So the Tucano are this group of 20 tribes who live in the Amazon, and they struck me as interesting because they tell this complex and compelling narrative about the relationship between humans and animals, the crux of which is that for every animal that's taken by the human community, that's hunted and eaten, a human soul needs to be given in return to be reborn as an animal of the same species. So there's this extraordinary sense of ontological and moral equivalence between humans and animals, all wrapped up in this really beautiful story about sort of the way that energy flows through the universe. But the practical implication of it, which I found fascinating, was that people are really careful to only eat what they need, because it's those who consume more meat than they need who will be given over to be reborn in the sort of body of the prey. So it puts a really interesting constraint on consumption. And I think that there's something to be learnt from these societies. I talk about various indigenous societies. I can't speak on their behalf, but I do cite the literature. And I think that they hopefully teach us something of what it means to tell a more coherent and compelling narrative about humans and animals and our place in the world. Currently, our cultural narrative is broken. Our relationship with the animal world is completely damaged and doing tremendous harm to our prospects of future prosperity. So I think that this big task of shifting the way that we eat and relate to the natural world begins with telling a more honest story about who we are and where we came from and what it means to eat animals. And the book tries to begin to tell that story, at least points towards its outline.
Yeah. What role does gender play in the attitudes people have about animal consumption?
Yeah, seemingly quite a big role. There's a quite marked split down the vegan community, for example. 80-90% of participants in Veganuary, this themed month of vegan eating in January, are are women, they're female. Similarly, the vegan community in the US and in Europe is disproportionately made up of women. And the literature suggests that men and women find different ways of handling the tensions of meat. Men are more unapologetic. They rationalize their consumption. They offer justifications and arguments and so on, many of which are often fairly flawed. Whereas women are more likely to sort of underreport their consumption in surveys and find different ways of sort of averting their gaze and handling those tensions. So there is a really interesting split. But ultimately, there is this common ground. We are empathetic creatures on a really fundamental level. And we don't like the idea that animals are harmed on our behalf, and killing animals means harming them. So we have this really difficult tension to grapple with.
One of the charges that those who try to keep people away from meat make is that there's a relationship between animal foods and chronic disease. I think the guy's name is Kip Anderson, who did a documentary, and you spent a little bit of time rebutting his thinking, just so we get completely clear the difference between animal eating and chronic disease.
Yeah, so I mean, there is a body of evidence associating high levels of red meat consumption with premature mortality, but that evidence is mostly found in Western populations consuming a highly processed diet, and it seems that there's a body of evidence which suggests if you're eating a really healthy omnivorous diet with lots of vegetables and so on, that association is nullified. But there are voices in the vegan movement who are by no means representative of all vegans, but who make really overblown claims about the health risks associated with meat. And Kip Anderson, I do discuss as the producer behind Cowspiracy in this film What the Health, who makes some less than credible claims, really positioning meat as the primary cause of a whole range of chronic diseases. And his misrepresentation of the evidence around cancer is particularly striking. And it's just not what the science says. And I think that ultimately some of this miscommunication is deliberate. It's propaganda. There are, I think, perfectly reasonable cases that can be made, compelling cases even, as to why one should go vegan. I'm really sympathetic towards this as an ethical cause. But I think that when you have these actors misrepresenting the science and portraying meat as toxic and poisonous and so on, it really doesn't do the public conversation or the cause any good at all.
Yeah, well, I was really pleased to see the focus on processed foods, because if you get right down to it, I think there is some science behind the fact that processed foods may indeed cause various cancers, at least in large quantities. But that's a topic for another conversation. You worked with Peter Melcher for the last 5 years of his life, and he certainly made a huge impact on this discussion. But I think I remember you saying not a very optimistic future. This is a pretty tough analysis of where we are and where we're going.
So Peter Melcher was policy director at the Soil Association, and he was previously the director of Greenpeace, and he was a sort of mentor to me of sorts, a tremendously successful campaigner who led various high-profile campaigns against the oil industry, genetically modified foods, ended up in jail for that particular protest, but was also an organic farmer. And the book ends on this note, looking ahead to, on the one hand, to this 4-degree world that we're currently heading towards and the disaster and sadness of it all. But on the other hand, it mirrors that with a tale around Peter converting his farm to organic, phasing out these chemical inputs and then watching this miraculous transformation as within the first 12 months, the farm had come back to life. Wildlife had returned. There were more badgers. There were more foxes. These birds, the migratory birds, turtle doves, were coming back from Africa who hadn't been there for many years. So there is an element of or a really strong message of hope at the end of the book. We are on the wrong course, the wrong track, but we have it in our hands, the future. We can turn it around. We can regenerate the land, bring nature back, and reverse much of the damage that we're currently doing. But it does require that we take concerted action in the next few years.
And one of the concerted actions we can take right now is to buy the book, The Meat Paradox by Rob Percival, subtitle, Eating, Empathy, and the Future of Meat. Rob, thanks so much for joining us today at Reader's Corner. This has been a great discussion, and I encourage our listeners to get out there and delve into your book and learn more about it. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Reader's Corner is presented by Boise State Public Radio News. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones, with production by Joel Wayne. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.